Hello, folks. We're actually going to do this program just a little bit different at the start. We're going to have Melissa Kane make a presentation on that topic. You may or may not be following that story. And then we'll have our other two panelists come up here, and we'll do our regular show along with Melissa. So let's get started with Melissa. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm sorry. I just heard I had a live mic when I was complaining about my diet. Said I've been on a diet for a whole day. I'm like, since breakfast, I'm exhausted. I really, really, team player. Okay, so today's topic is how to stop Donald Trump, but I want you to know first off that we're not going to talk trash about Donald Trump. We're not going to talk about his hand size or his necktie sales prowess. We are going to talk about Donald Trump as more of a case study in how the power of delegates plays out at the Republican convention. Now, some folks in this room might be feeling the burn and might be pretty upset about how those superdelegates are keeping Hillary Clinton's delegate count way up. And you might at the same time be thinking, man, I wish the Republican Party had something like a superdelegate to prevent a Donald Trump presidency. And that's totally okay. Again, today we're talking about how this all plays out. So there's sort of three parts to what I'm going to present today. And it's only going to take about 10 minutes because we really want to get to Carson and Chuck and get everybody back on stage. So this is going to be pretty quick, but the three topics are sort of the three parts here are, number one, we're going to talk a little bit about who the delegates are and where do they come from. And then we're going to talk about two different scenarios, two different ways to stop a Trump nomination as the GOP presidency. And remember, again, he's just a case study. You can insert the word Ted Cruz. You can insert John Kasich. You can insert Donald Duck. It doesn't matter. The point is, there are ways on the Republican side to keep the to keep someone from becoming the nominee, right? Okay, so the first thing you should know about delegates is that they are not the Illuminati, right? They're not the secret society of Opus Dei who gets together and decides the fate of the country. No, they are super normal, fun people. These are actual Texas delegates from 2012, and they showed up every day to the convention, a ton of them, of course, dressed exactly alike. It was kind of embarrassing, but so fun. But they're super normal, fun people. How many people here has anyone here ever been to a convention, a political convention? See, normal, nice people here. Have you been delegates? Anyone been a delegate from a convention? There you go. Again, normal, nice people. Okay, so remember though that when we're voting for people, when we're voting in primaries and caucuses, what we're basically doing is voting for delegates. We're saying, hey, delegates, here's how you gotta go vote. In South Carolina, for example, Donald Trump wins, all 50 delegates in South Carolina have to go vote for Trump. What's important at a convention is what the delegates do, not what you and I do. The popular vote is not relevant at a convention, only those delegates. And that's a cartoon of Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft fishing for delegates off a pier in a very contentious 1812 election cartoon. I love that you nerds get that. I'm sorry. Oh, sorry, 1912. See? God. That was a test. You all passed. Okay. So who are these delegates and who are they loyal to? About 600 of them are picked by the candidates or approved by the candidates. Now, for Democrats, they're all approved by the candidates. But on the Republican side, there's only a little less than 600 who are actually approved or chosen by the candidates. And California is one state where candidates approve the entire slate of the delegates. So when we talk about what are the loyalties of these delegates, only less than 600 are actually sort of true believers, have the stamp of the candidate's approval on their delegate status. 200 of them are either party leaders or chosen by like party executive committees, right? This might be termed the dreaded establishment people. And then all of the rest, like 1,700 other people, like the vast majority of people at this convention, these guys are, the national convention are chosen at the local and state conventions, right? This is super important. 44 states either choose all or some of their delegates at a state convention. So let me give you an example of here's some folks This is a list, and why Delaware? This is a list of Delaware's delegates to the 2012 election. And why Delaware? It's a small state. There weren't very many delegates. And I could find the list pretty easily. So if you look at these folks, here you see Board of Education members, commissioners, right? We're talking about local folks who either volunteer for the party, they give money to the party, they're local officers to the party. But if you look there at the bottom for Thomas there is a Ron Paul supporter. And in 2012, Delaware went entirely for Mitt Romney. And that meant all those delegates, including our friend Thomas here, had to go to the convention and vote for Mitt Romney, right? This is what I need you to understand very, very carefully, because this is going to frame everything else. The delegates are not chosen to match the person they're going to have to vote for. You can think one thing as a delegate and vote for another. Let me give you another example. Mitt Romney, of course, won his home state of Massachusetts in 2012. But 16 Ron Paul delegates got themselves elected at the state convention, and it was pretty embarrassing. It was not as embarrassing as like the Clint Eastwood talking to a chair thing, but it was still pretty embarrassing for Mitt, for his home state to have these 16 Ron Paul delegates. So that's just, again, another example of how it is that a candidate can think one thing and have to vote for another. These people who think one thing and vote for another, are going to be critical to any kind of sort of plan or idea that they're of sort of changing the nominee of the Republican convention. All right, so the last thing you should know about the convention delegates is this. We don't know who they are yet, right? So the state conventions don't start until March 12th. They run all the way to June. So I can't tell you who these folks are, who they actually care about, as opposed to who they're supposed to vote for. Okay, so the reason we talk about these delegates, again, is because it's their actions that are going to sort of dictate whether or not Donald Trump ends up being the nominee. All right, so to recap, most delegates are chosen at conventions. Delegates not chosen by the candidates, so those party folks and the convention folks, don't have to love the candidate they're voting for. And lastly, we don't know who the delegates are yet. All right, so having that little background, we're going to start with scenario one. Scenario one is the contested convention. Now, this is what we talk about when we hear terms like brokered convention, open convention. This is, if you're a candidate not named Donald Trump, this is your best hope, right? This is your only hope, is this contested convention. Okay, basically what this means is Donald Trump shows up and he does not have a majority of the delegates he needs to be the nominee. Right. Yes, you hope. But okay.
You blow me up.
Okay, so we'll go back to that. So what happens is you get to the convention and there's round one, right? And round one happens and nobody gets elected, right? Because nobody's got a majority. It's sort of like
you
American
blow me
Idol.
Off like it's all the same. You lit it fierce and I'm taking away like a bomb. Yeah, babe.
Okay. It's like American Idol. The first round doesn't produce a winner. It's just fun, right? You just do it. You enjoy it, but you're not actually going to find a winner. All right. So here's what happens. After that first round, nobody wins. Here's what people often fail to understand. Over 1,000 delegates become unbound, right? So that means that delegate who was like, Ted Cruz, I got to vote for Donald Trump. That person's like free to now vote for Ted Cruz if they want. They're free to vote for Donald Trump if they want. They're free to vote for Beyonce if they want. As long as she's 35, she might not be. Anyway, she probably wouldn't take the pay cut. But the point is, you don't have to necessarily have been on the ballot even to get all the votes. What we are talking about is the prospect of thousands of people who can do what they want to do. And so we talk about it as a brokered convention. But that's the wrong word. Brokered convention sounds organized. It sounds like there's a grown-up in the room who's doing this stuff. No. Okay? Like, there's no Lyndon Johnson Republican who's, like, in a hotel room, like, pulling the levers and figuring this stuff out. Brokered convention is an aspirational thing, and it is going to be more like a total freaking mess. More like the last scene in Animal House when there's like the marching band marching into a brick wall and like the you know, things are on fire. Like this, imagine there's thousands of delegates who can do whatever they want to do. And there's nobody really in charge who's brokering it. So I prefer open convention or contested convention to sort of, you know, not imbue this with a sort of organizational thing that you can trust. So understand, this is going to be a nightmare, and it is the best case scenario. Okay, this is what these guys are trying to do. Okay, and so it's natural that you'd have a question. Your question would be, how likely is it that Trump is going to show up to the convention without the number of votes that he needs, right? How likely is this contested convention? And here's the thing. If you take all of the primary votes and the caucus votes and you put them in one big bucket, right? So the total number of votes that have been cast so far, Donald Trump has won 34%, Ted Cruz has won 29%, and Marco Rubio has won 21%. All right, so again, you're going to do this 10 different ways and you're going to come up with 10 different answers. But what I did is I plugged in these numbers to every single subsequent contest. And the answer is, by the date of the Republican convention, Donald Trump will have 1,477 delegates. And that is more than he needs to get the nomination. So I'm not saying it's impossible to beat him. What I'm saying is, that's not like a huge lead. That's not an impossible lead. But it's one of the reasons why we talk so much about Ohio and Florida, right? Is because if Kasich can win Ohio and Rubio can win Florida, you go a long way toward denying that majority. And that's why there's, you know, all this money and all this attention on these two races. If Trump wins both Ohio and Florida, it is going to be an incredible backflip to prevent him from getting the nomination. It's almost guaranteed that he would. So it is, to some degree, there is a good chance. It's very, very possible that he's going to show up with the right number of votes to become the nominee, which brings us to scenario two. Okay, scenario two is the nuclear option. No one wants to do this, but I want to talk about what's possible, not what's probable, because what's possible can become what's probable the closer we get to the convention, when the Republican Party has to weigh, do we blow up the party or do we just go ahead and let him become the nominee? But I just, from a rules perspective, I'm a strictly like technical perspective, I want to talk about what's possible here. This scenario entirely depends on this. It entirely depends on people showing up to the convention who have to vote for Donald Trump, but who don't want to, right? So what that means is that Rubio and Cruz have to like infiltrate. They have to infiltrate all those conventions, all the local ones, the Sarasota County Republican Party. They have to do everywhere. They have to infiltrate all those conventions and get their people into the convention, into the national convention where they can vote against Donald Trump. This is what I call the Henry VIII scenario. What this means, because what this scenario is this. Before there's a vote, before there can be a majority Trump vote, the delegates agree to change the rules. Just like Henry VIII, I don't like the outcome, I'm fixing to change the rules. We will just start our own thing. That is why I call this Henry VIII. But because people don't understand, at every convention, the delegates have to adopt the rules that are going to sort of govern the convention. And I'll give you an example. In 2012, and this is a tiny example, we're going to talk about a much bigger one. A tiny example is in 2012, the Republican delegates adopted a rule called Rule 40B. Okay, Rule 40B says that in order to be considered a presidential nominee, you have to get a majority of the delegates, not the vote, of the delegates of 8 states. Now, this really did nothing more than prevent Ron Paul from being considered a nominee, right? And of course, the supporters knew it. And it was a big deal, and Ron Paul had won like 185 delegates, and he should have been, you know, the people should have been able to be on the floor casting votes for him. But to prevent that from happening, to keep like a unanimous Mitt Romney thing going, they passed Rule 40B. And that's just an example of a rule that you can pass that can disenfranchise a certain candidate. And I'm going to show you a video right now from, that is not it. There we go. This is from the 2012 convention. Now, I want you to understand, the delegates know that this Rule 40B is about to get passed. And I want you to listen to what happens in a very tiny fraction of what we could face if the delegates in this year's convention tried to make that kind of change. So this is the chairman of the Rules Committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, fellow delegates, I offer the following resolution and I ask for its immediate consideration.
They're yelling,
Mr.
Point
Chairman,
of order. They're trying to get
I offer this resolution
can,
and ask for its immediate consideration. Resolved that the rules as printed and distributed be adopted as the rules for the election and the governing of the Republican National Committee, the rules under which delegates and alternate delegates shall be elected, selected, and allocated, and the rules which serve as the rules of the Republican National Convention. These rules incorporate the changes adopted by the Convention Committee on Rules and Order of Business at our meeting today. Substitute language for Rule 16A2 that has been adopted by the committee has been separately distributed and is part of this report. Before I move for adoption, I would like to thank my co-chairman, Enid Bickelson from Utah, and Vice Chairman Lewis Pope from Maryland, for their service on the committee. I certainly have been honored to have served as chairman of this committee and to present these rules for adoption. Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the rules of the Republican Party and the resolution. These rules will provide a strong governing framework for our convention.
That's the chairman.
And for our party. Thank you.
Thank you. Without objection, the previous question is ordered. The question is on the adoption of the resolution. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed, no. Any other chair? The ayes have it. The resolution is adopted. Without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
Right. So you see, the chairman has a lot of power to take these kinds of motions from the floor and to make these changes. And what you saw was a rule that would sort of disenfranchise about 180 folks. Imagine a contest where you were trying to change the rules to make sure that Trump was not the nominee. Imagine this times like a million and include like Trump supporters who are not all the most restrained. Restrained people? Like this could be insane. And so no one wants this to happen, right? Again, the party does not want this to happen. And in fact, they might actually prefer a Trump candidacy to this, to like 1968 Chicago, cars flipped over and burned in the parking lots. And again, remember, it really requires Cruz and Trump, people who can't get themselves elected to infiltrate all of these local conventions, which, so that's a questionable proposition too. But assuming they could, this could happen. Now, this is a cartoon again from the 1912 convention where, after which, Teddy Roosevelt formed his Bull Moose Party, having been on the losing end of some decisions at the Republican convention. So, look, it's not the preferred way of doing things, but what we know, based on what we know this year, is that when it comes to politics, anything can happen. Okay? So, with that, I will close, and we'll bring up the other panelists, and we'll begin. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa. We, of course, have to point out the Commonwealth Club is not taking a side on whether Trump should be dumped in any certain particular way. But if you've been following a lot of what's going on in the Republican Party lately, you know these are the conversations that are going on, especially when they're all getting together behind closed doors. Melissa, of course, is a huge Trump supporter, so.
Full disclosure, my shoes are Ivanka Trump. Just so you know. A little biased.
Actually, I should say I have a BS degree from Trump University also.
Well, listen, welcome to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club for Monday, March 7th, 2016. This was the week, by the way, in which Senator Bernie Sanders was praised by, wait for it, the National Rifle Association.
Oh.
It's true. They tweeted support for something he said in response to Hillary Clinton's gun control ideas. So he's got their vote. Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week. On today's program, we're going to, of course, talk a bit more about this incredible heated presidential primary campaign. We'll also talk about the Supreme Court post-Antonin Scalia, Apple versus the FBI, the mentally ill on our streets, and, of course, some other political news. We always note that the Commonwealth Club is a place of people with a wide variety of views, even Trump supporters. So any views that are expressed up here are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for today. Starting on the far end of the stage is Carson Bruno, a research fellow specializing in California politics and policy at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He's on Twitter at Carson J.F. Bruno. Next to him, you know Melissa Kane, a political analyst for CBS San Francisco, also a host of The Cheat Sheet, which you can find on YouTube. I recommend you hunt it down. She's also an attorney, and she's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. And next to me is...
Melissa Kane was taken, sorry.
And next to me is Chuck Nevius, as you know him as C.W. Nevius, a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. He's on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. So there are question cards
because
out
Melissa
there.
Melissa Kane was taken.
So. Yes. I've already got some questions. Please keep sending up your questions, and I'll try to get as many asked as possible during the program. So on to our roundtable. Let's just start with Trump. I mean, I've run out of snappy intros to discussions of Donald Trump. So let's actually leave it to former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who today said he was not going to run for president. And anyone, what was his excuse for, or his reason for not running?
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Is that what he said?
Yeah. Yeah, he was afraid that if he were to run, it would throw the election to Donald Trump, regardless of if it was Clinton or Sanders at the on the top of the ticket for the Democratic side.
So he seemed to believe that his running would take more from the Democrats than the Republicans?
Yeah, which played out in the polling, the very limited polling that we've been seeing. On a three-way kind of head.
That he would be a third party. He'd be a third-party candidate,
yes.
That's a tough row. Yeah. It's hard to get a third party going.
What's amazing is his consultants that were kind of forming this presidential campaign in the wings, in the waiting, were just really trying to make it sound like he could win the thing. If you actually looked at the map that they were showing him with the polling and everything like that, it actually showed him winning a majority of Electoral College with Sanders as the Democratic nominee.
Wow.
So they were definitely pushing. They wanted some money.
And Dorothy and Toto as Secretary of State.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This was consultants gone
little,
wild.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really...
This seems a little wild. Yeah.
They saw a billionaire like, oh, yes. We can retire early if we do this.
Yeah. Well, I think to Melissa's point, what she said before, the idea that, and we've all said this, but the idea at this point in the election, we'd be saying that Trump was the guy controlling the race is crazy. But the other thing is that we could say broker convention with a straight face. And not only that, some of the candidates are saying, I mean, Rubio and Kasich are acting like that's a strategy. Like, you know, I win my home state, you know, things don't break the right way, who knows what happened. And this would be, as you said, you know, marching bands marching into a brick wall. We'd love to see it, those of us who have to write about it.
This,
we like that.
This is the time of year where you usually see reporters talking about contested conventions because that's, I mean, is every reporter, is every pundit, I mean, anyone who's involved in politics, their kind of their dream is to actually see a real contested convention. But this is the first time that you can really see the candidates actually trying to angle for one and actually trying to convince their supporters to vote strategically so that they can get to one. It's quite something in the political world right now.
Well, and to look back at it and think, this is the best we have to go against Trump. I mean, there's nobody else that could, you know, I guess Kasich is trying to be the adult in the room, but he's kind of a dish rag himself, really. I mean, I don't see a leader here, do you? I mean, I don't see someone, and Trump is
dish rag?
Ouch.
Maybe dish rag's a little harsh. But yeah.
Okay, so there was a headline that I guess was fairly old, but I just saw it pop up again, which is that Mitt Romney actually has filed papers with the FEC to be a candidate, possibly. Now, Melissa, you've said, obviously, he couldn't even be on the ballot in a lot of states. Is that a play to have his name on that wild, contested Chicago 1968-type convention floor?
Well, I mean, of course, in his big speech, you know, I guess, you know, America's Choice is trying to be Reagan's speech. You know, he did, you know, he very sort of pointedly did not endorse any of the candidates left on the ballot, sort of leaving the door open for himself. He has since said, oh, no, this was not me trying to, you know, get myself named. No, don't be silly. Which, like, everyone with, like, a mother-in-law is like, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they're just like, oh, forget about me. It's not about me.
I'll be fine.
So I don't know how genuine his sort of post-speech, you know, deflection has been. I think, you know, if they really came crawling at the convention in Cleveland, he would deign to entertain the option of being the guy. But it's hard to believe he's going to do any better than like a Kasich or a Rubio. I mean, as an establishment candidate, it's like, what is it that he's bringing to the table that's going to get the Cruz supporters or maybe some Trump supporters? I don't really see it. But yeah, I don't buy at all his denial that he's interested.
Yeah, what did you think of his speech? Or did it? My assumption was, watching this or hearing about it, was that Mitt Romney criticizing Donald Trump is exactly what Trump supporters don't like about the Republican Party, that he is the establishment they say has not delivered the change they want. So did he just help Trump with that? I mean,
I think it was helpful in the sense that you're never going to convince Trump supporters to vote for someone else. Mm-hmm. They may not vote, but they're not going to go vote for Cruz, Rubio, or Kasich at this point. What the party elites, establishment, you know, these people in the back room that really aren't really in the back room, what they should have been doing was this much earlier, trying to convince people that yes, Trump is a threat and that we actually do have to vote strategically here, not maybe coalesce around one person if it seems like one person can't win all the, you know, the delegates they need to, but, you know, vote for Cruz where, you know, Cruz is strongest, vote for Rubio, vote for Kasich where they're each strongest, to basically deny anyone a majority going into the convention.
But, you know, we've said that over and over, and they have not coalesced, and they have not put it together, and it is only now that they're starting to do it. And again, I just don't see someone who's making a good, solid challenge to Donald Trump. And, you know, there's an interesting story in Politico. I don't know if you saw it, but he's got to win. They calculate he has to win 7 out of 10 white guys. And what they did is they went back to the races, George Bush, the original George Bush, the first George Bush, Ronald Reagan. They won like 63% of white males. But Romney won 62% of white males, and he lost by 3 million votes. I mean, Trump's window is a lot smaller than people think, and I think they could exploit that, but they aren't.
I do think that is quite plausible if everything were to go as planned. And I think Melissa did a fantastic job of talking about what the end of the tunnel looks like. But how do you, like, what does that tunnel look like to get to the end of it? Mm-hmm. And the key is, moving forward, is that majority of the primaries caucuses are now moving into the winner-take-all or pseudo-winner-take-all area. I mean, some big prizes here, Florida, Ohio, Illinois. I mean, we're talking about California. California actually sends the largest delegation to the RNC every year, which is crazy, but I mean, we are the most populous state.
They make fun of our delegates.
Yeah.
I interviewed them in Tampa last year, and really, I guess the Texas delegates are like really fired up because they're like, we're Texas, we're Republicans, and we're huge. And California, you're adorable, but like, you have no statewide Republican people there.
And we always get put in the hotel, delegates sort of, yeah, throw us away.
We're kind of in the locker. We're like, our delegates are kind of
But the key here is also not only are they going to be more winner take all, but they're also going to be closed primaries. Only Republicans can vote. For now, quite a few of the states were open. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, anyone could vote in their caucus or primary. And that has actually had an effect. Trump has done significantly better in the open primaries and caucuses, beating Cruz by about 7-ish points versus the closed primaries that have happened already, where Cruz is actually performing the best in those closed primaries. But it's been kind of stacked open at the beginning, and now we're moving into the closed ones. So if this kind of moves forward, you could actually see a case where it's actually quite easy for a Cruz-Rubio-Kasich kind of team to stop Trump from getting majority of the delegates.
It's interesting you mentioned the open-closed primary, because I was just handed a question from someone who says who signed it, Rob, a former Republican. So, but he's asking specifically about in California, you know, could we see that kind of thing where...
If you want to vote against Trump in the state of California, you have to register as a Republican.
Yeah, we do not. We have an open primary, and we have the sort of top two, but it doesn't apply to the presidential election, right? So if you are declined to state, you have to pick either Republican or Democrat. Would you have to pick sort of which ballot you want? I know because I'm a declined to state, and I got that in the mail. But sort of I can pick that as a declined to state, but as a Democrat can't vote in the Republican primary.
So what about a crazy idea that California might actually be relevant in terms of making the choice?
I think there's no question that we'll be relevant.
Yeah, it's going
to
be.
We're so excited.
We won't know what to do with that.
We're so excited.
We're so used to being a throwaway.
So the decision usually is pretty much made by the time the California primary comes around.
Well, we're the last.
In both parties, or do you think just the Republican will
just
be?
Just Republican.
Okay.
In my opinion.
The thing to remember, too, about the Republican primary in California, it's winner-take-all, but it's a weird, funky winner-take-all, right? So there's sort of 10 statewide delegates that all go to the person who wins statewide. All our other delegates, all three, they're broken into congressional districts, and each district gets three delegates. So the top winner in every congressional district gets three delegates. So if
is
you
this
can...
This is my
picture of, like, candidates trying to pick through the state, like, Bakersfield is three delegates. San Francisco is three delegates. Yeah. Fresno is three delegates. Oh, sorry, that's a countdown here. Fresno is three delegates. LA is three delegates. So weirdly, not only might California be relevant, but San Francisco, the Bay Area, might be relevant because our congressional districts are as good as those three delegates are as good as the ones from some other place. You can't just campaign in the Central Valley and win and everything is fine. You've got to go to every congressional district to try to win. And so if it's as close as we think it's going to be, we might actually see people campaigning here instead of just coming here for money.
And that's Carson. And that's really that's an important distinction with California because Nancy Pelosi's congressional district sends the same number of delegates as Kevin McCarthy's. And there are a fraction of Republicans in Nancy Pelosi's as there are in Kevin McCarthy's. So you can just, your buck goes a long way if you focus it in on the urban San Francisco, LA, San Diego congressional districts because there aren't many Republicans there to kind of try to convince to vote for you. So versus going to someplace Central Valley where you have to spend a lot more money because there's a lot more Republicans there.
So when does the Trump helicopter land in Union Square? That's our question, right?
Right. Yeah. So
it could actually be important to him.
Right. It can be
San
very.
San Francisco could be important to him.
But it doesn't require a lot of money. Everyone thinks California, and they think of the governor races, the senatorial races that require tens of millions of dollars to be able to compete statewide. You don't really have to compete statewide. You're running mini congressional elections up and down the states. And so a Kasich, who may not have a lot of money in his bank account by the time June rolls around, can come in and kind of pick off the districts that he thinks he can compete in based off of demographics, based off of whatever, and be able to actually fund it and win a few delegates out of the whole thing.
It's never failing to surprise me just how each state does this completely different. I mean, it's like reading about the Holy Roman Empire where, it's like a mixture of you cross one line and suddenly you're speaking a different language.
But it's the power of the political parties. Remember this year, Colorado, I think North Dakota and Wyoming, they're not even having elections. You know why? Because their state political party is like, eh, we don't want to have elections. No caucus, no election, no nothing. They're just sending delegates unbound to the convention. People think that there's some sort of constitutional right or some sort of legal right to even participate in a primary caucus. No. No, no, no. There's no right to any of it. And the states get to make up their own rules as they go. That's why you saw Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, the elections being decided by in certain precincts by coin tosses, right? Or in Las Vegas, certain precincts, the elections were decided by cards, right? Appropriately enough. But I just mean, like, the states can. There's so much flexibility. There's so much power. And people don't realize how little legal recourse they have to allege like a disenfranchisement when a state is determining whether or not they're even going to bother to have one of these elections.
Okay, now I know if we asked you this, you would say, oh, no, we don't want to talk about that. But you all saw the Republican debate on Thursday or have heard about it. Donald Trump went there. And my question almost is, I guess is, so if the Republican Party manages to really make him mad. I mean, this is him speaking when he was a bit upset at a debate. What do you think?
How
this
upset
man
was he? Was he a little?
Just can't resist, Carrie. It's just
I don't know where you guys are thinking. That was a genuine question.
Well, even in last night's debate, I don't know if you caught Bernie Sanders at one point. He was talking about some huge spending. He's like, I probably shouldn't say huge.
Did you hear the new diagram to Bernie Sanders' sentence? Did you hear that? It's noun, verb, Wall Street. Every sentence is that.
Actually, you probably have seen also the news about, you know, Chris Christie, who formerly could not stand Donald Trump, then endorsed Donald Trump.
Stockholm syndrome.
It was in the news quiz in Huffington Post this week about how he actually, in a press conference, had to deny that he was being held hostage during a press conference where he was just standing behind Donald Trump.
Not to pile up, but my favorite tweet of that was, he looks just like my dog when he realizes we're going to the vet.
Well, and to bring it a bit local, Meg Whitman, who, of course, former candidate for governor. And now I guess she's the head of HP. She was Chris Christie's national finance chairman or something like that. She unloaded on Chris Christie in a statement, just calling him an opportunist. And this is horrible. And you know.
She also donated to an anti-Trump pack.
She has.
One of the packs that are...
let's talk about that, because there are a number of big money Republicans who finally have said, you know, we've got to get behind this. The Koch brothers actually said, no, they weren't going to do that. But then I saw some Koch-linked PAC is funding anti-Trump ads. Is that going to play into any of the, you know, attempt to stop Trump, or is that just going to give newspapers a little bit long lease on life with some advertising? I mean,
well, I think you've got to consider the Marco Rubio lesson, which was, if you're going to get down in the gutter, it's like they always say, if you wrestle a pig in mud, you both get muddy, the pig enjoys it. You know, I mean, that was the worst. That's what you always see when, you know, the nerd thinks he has this great one-liner and he just can't wait to put it out there. How about his hands? And it's like his numbers went down immediately. So if you attack him in Florida, and what is it, $10 million they're bringing into Florida, you want to attack him on something that's going to stick. I mean, for some reason, Trump University has stuck. That's one. His business deals and so forth. But a lot of it, it's like, gee, Trump was vulgar. Everybody goes, I know. It's, you know, he's like, hitting it all the time. I think it's great.
You have to go after the essence of Trump. It's this idea that he is a winner, you know? And if you can kind of chip away at that essence, that, again, it's not going to flip his voters. His voters are voting for Trump, but they may not vote at all. And that's the important thing, getting them not to vote, or at least trying to convince people to coalesce around one of the other people, especially in these winner-take-all states like Florida and Ohio.
Okay, so that's people spending now big money against him. Someone in the audience asks, if Trump is the nominee, will the RNC, the Republican National Conference, whatever the
convention
name.
Will
the National Republican Party spend money to support his candidacy, or will they? I don't know if you remember when Barack Obama got elected to the Senate. It was with a big assist from the Republican candidate in that state, who basically imploded, sex scandal, got out of office, and they brought in this guy who was so far to the right that Republican leaders in the state were saying, we're not voting for him. You know, will the Republican Party put money behind his candidacy, or will they walk away and say, we'll come back in 4 years?
Here's what I think. I think they have to a certain degree. It may not be what you would have seen if it was another more kind of mainstream Republican candidate, but they have to do some sort of level of investment just to really kind of save everyone down ballot. What we saw in Nevada in 2014 when Brian Sandoval, the current governor of Nevada who is running for re-election, the Democrats put up literally a no-name person. And what that did, it just decimated the down ballot for the rest of the Democratic ticket. They lost every single statewide office. They lost both houses of the state legislature when no one was expecting either chamber to be competitive. So it just goes to show you that if you really abandon the top of the ticket, it does reverberate downward. And so they have to do at least some sort of level of investment. If it's just get out the vote efforts and kind of just more structural infrastructure sort of stuff in order to help save some of the Senate candidates, House candidates, governor candidates that are running in those states.
And remember, too, the RNC can only give what it has, right? Yeah. And it doesn't print money. It has to give money that people give it, and then it sort of figures out where the best places are to put that. So if the money dries up or goes to a trickle, if with the Trump candidacy, you know, it can only do what it can do, you know, based on the contributions that it's getting. So really, that's really where that part of the funnel is really what's going to determine how much money they're able to put into the campaign.
And to take the most cynical possible view, they'll back him if they think he can win. You know, if they think he can win, a lot of people are going to have a Chris Christie moment. You know, they're all going to be like, hey. Yeah. But if, you know, and it's, you know, you can run the numbers as much as you want. I mean, it's Hispanics and women who are not going to vote for him. I mean, there's a lot of reasons to think he won't win. But right, we thought that for how many months? 9 months now.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say is Carly Fiorina did not have many good moments during her campaign, but she had one, and that was when Trump criticized her looks. And she said, I think every woman in America knows what he's saying. And it's going to be a different deal if it's Hillary Clinton. If he bullies her, it's not going to be a good look. And I think people will turn on him.
Well, let's talk about the Democrats. After Super Tuesday, the press coverage that I was seeing flipped pretty quickly and started saying, okay, Bernie, the writing's on the wall. It's very clear. You've got a very narrow path at this point. You would have to, you know, the math for him then got very bad. Even though he continues to, you know, win a caucus here or something. Is it largely over for him? And if so, should he stay in to make his point? Should he stay in and have a fun time at the convention? Should he get out for the good of the party that he barely acknowledges exists?
Why not? You know, if I was Bernie, why not? Why not stick around? I think he's accomplished something, which is to move Hillary toward his positions. The chances, it was always a long shot. In his heart of hearts, he probably never thought he'd get this far. And now he's kind of having a great time, you know. Whatever the time in his life, is he going to be on the national news nightly? He can make news with anything he says. He's doing these debates. He honestly believes in what he's doing. He has some money. Why not go to the camp? Why not go to the convention and see what comes of it?
He has a lot of money. I mean, he's outraising Hillary Clinton right now, which is an amazing feat, given that, especially that small dollar. I mean, completely small dollar. Right. I mean, he's not really doing any big dollar stuff. So, yeah, I agree. Why?
And she wouldn't have moved if he wasn't ringing the bell. There's a movement behind him. There's a movement behind him that is, you know, they're ardent. They want to make something of this, even though they know it's a long shot.
Now, along those lines, though, yes, there's a movement there. There's a movement behind Trump. As someone in the audience asks, why are Democrats unconcerned that they have about 30% fewer popular votes in the primaries than the Republican candidates? It has been pointed out in the past. Yes, Bernie has the support, but they actually haven't increased the number of Democrats going to the polls. The Republicans have. Are they the ones with the excitement behind them?
Well, I don't think the Democrats are unconcerned. I think they see that it's an issue. But at the same time, if it's going to be a Trump or even a Ted Cruz, guys, remember, before Barack Obama, we used to vote against people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there was, you know, for the most part, a lot of turnout is driven not by who you're fired up about, but by who you're really scared about. And Hillary Clinton does that on the does that to the folks on the right, and Donald Trump and Ted Cruz do that to folks on the left. So while in the primaries, you're not seeing as much of a turnout because maybe folks don't think that there's a huge difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. I think when it comes to the general election, if it is a Trump or even a Cruz on the right, you will see a big turnout on the left. And again, if it's Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders on the left, it's going to drive turnout on the right as well. So I don't necessarily think that, a low turnout or a less than 2008 or 2012 turnout in the primary means that Hillary folks are going to sit home. I guarantee you if it comes if you're a Hillary supporter and it comes down to Hillary versus Donald Trump, you're going to make time to get out and cast your ballot. I'm pretty freaking sure.
And let's also remember, I mean, primaries and caucuses are low turnout affairs anyway. And yes, we're seeing a little bump in the Republican side versus 2012 or 2008, depending on the baseline. But you're still just talking about, you know, single digits in caucus in the caucus states and, you know, maybe, you know, 20 to 30% turnout in the primary states. So you're not talking about a lot of people, especially compared to what to expect then in November at the general election.
Well, two things. One is if your campaign, as Hillary Clinton's campaign was, is to create an air of inevitability, then it's kind of hard to complain about not getting much of a turnout because, you know, it's inevitable, right? So, and to Carson's point, I mean, I remember in Iowa when Cruz was crowing about Iowa, and I think I have this right, I think he had about 41,000 votes, which is essentially a Giants home game. So I don't know that that's a mandate to lead America, you know?
Someone asks, doesn't Bernie Sanders have a super PAC? And if so, why doesn't anyone talk about it? I thought he did not. Am I wrong? Does he have a super PAC?
There is one. He's disavowed it,
oh, yes?
I think, multiple times because he doesn't like the whole PAC thing. But there is one. But I don't know if they're spending serious amounts of money, though.
Okay. Nancy Pelosi, our own local U.S. representative for many of us in here, has not yet endorsed. Is that a sign of actual ambivalence, or is she waiting for the right time? Do we assume she will vote for Hillary Clinton? Do we know?
Melissa knows that.
It seems a little premature. It seems like, look, she's letting her her constituents, there's a lot of folks who live in her district who like Bernie Sanders, right? And why alienate those people before you have to, before it becomes inevitable? Look, Hillary Clinton won California in 2008. She beat Barack Obama in 2008. It's pretty likely that she's going to win again in this year's primary elections as well. So I think it's more she's just not willing to sort of make enemies without it being necessary at this point. But I think ultimately she will endorse Hillary.
It's not an oversight. She didn't forget to endorse somebody. I mean,
there's a reason.
There's a reason why she's not doing it. Yeah.
One last question before we move on. Someone asked about, you know, these various Republican threats to file charges against Hillary Clinton for, name your thing, Benghazi email server thing. Just fun things, or does she have a future behind bars?
Well, if she goes behind bars, she's definitely got a future. She could be running that prison, I'll tell you.
Yeah. I'm not sure being behind bars would prevent her candidate. She can do it from behind bars.
I thought that story, the story was so optimistically spun. The idea that we've checked, and no foreign powers were able to hack into Hillary's email account. So you ran the red light, but luckily there was no cop around, so you didn't get caught. I mean, it's still stupid. It was still stupid to put it on your private server. It's still a dumb thing to do. And
but it's
shame
also
on her for banging you over the
it's
head.
It's also still a clearly partisan thing. I mean, are those people who are upset about that also upset about, you know, the Cheney Bush emails, 20 million of them that just kind of disappeared because they're on a private RNC server.
The one thing she needs to watch out for, and this actually is regardless of what the email whole saga is, was going to happen or is going to happen, Hillary Clinton has a honesty, trustworthy issue. She has for a long time. It's really showing up in the polling numbers, really showing up in the exit polls when you look at kind of even what Democrats are thinking. So that's something she needs to really be watching out for. And I'm surprised they haven't been doing more to try to take care of that when She has, yeah, a contested primary that she's going through, but not one that's really existential threat to her nomination. That she they aren't doing more to kind of shore up that honest, trustworthy thing, because that, if anything, is going to nail her.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
Like, show somebody, like, falling backwards.
I don't know.
And you catch them, and you're like, see, right. I can be trusted.
It's not being as kind of technical and legalese and kind of shifty whenever she's trying to explain what happened with her email server.
Isn't that in her DNA, though? I mean, she just absolutely, she starts with a minimum.
It's
I'm not going to do any more. Well, all right, a little bit more, and it just
feeds the idea. And then something comes out,
and
this drip is just not been helping her at all, and yeah. I'm surprised they haven't been way more proactive in trying to get her to just go on stage, be up front, kill it in the, you know, nip it in the bud, and move on. And
on a Friday
they just really aren't
on a
doing
Friday
that.
Afternoon late.
And there's a lot of Democrats, and it's just not me being, you know, a Republican here. It's a lot of Democrats who are kind of scratching their heads also, thinking, why isn't she doing this? Because that's going to be her Achilles heel if there is anything. The honest trustworthiness.
Yeah, I just don't think she's a bud nipper. She's going to fight it every step of the way.
Bud nipper. Bud nipper? Is she a dish rag?
No. It's a whole different dish rag. Dish rag's
totally
a whole,
different.
Whole
okay.
different thing. Yeah.
Well, moving on to our next topic, a surprise, I think, to everybody occurred recently when Justice Antonin Scalia of the U.S. Supreme Court passed away while on a hunting trip in Texas. This suddenly put one of actually Hillary Clinton's big issues she's been talking about, which is, you know, whoever you're going to vote for, remember, Supreme Court, right? They're expecting 2, possibly 3 seats that could, you know, be nominated by the next president. Well, this suddenly made that topic immediate. So maybe starting with you, Melissa, especially as our lawyer, first of all, before we get to the issues of, you know, should the Senate hold hearings and all that kind of stuff, tell us, how does the Supreme Court operate now with, there are 4-4, presumably, they can have a tie, they do, what do they do? What do they do about cases they've already held that he voted on they haven't announced yet? Give us a primer
right,
on that.
To take your last question first, if there's a case that he's already voted on, even if he's already sort of written an opinion and approved it, it's if it hasn't been published, anything short of being published sort of goes back in the bullpen. So even if he had already written something and voted, there's no posthumous publishing of opinions, right? And so even if he wrote something that maybe you really want him to write or wanted his opinion to be weighed in on, it's not going to work. You have to go all the way back to the drawing board. Okay, so that's question one. Question two, okay, so if there's 4-4, you know, the lower court decision stays in place. But if it's a 4-4 decision and they issue like a one sentence thing, and it basically just says, you know, we couldn't come to a decision. It's kicking back to the lower court. It's like one sentence. And the important thing to know about that is that it doesn't establish a precedent, right? So it's not like the lower court ruling becomes the law of America, right? The lower court ruling is still just the lower court ruling. It just means that it's just as if the Supreme Court had never taken it. It's just as if the Supreme Court had never seen it. The last thing, and the thing I think we're going to see more and more of, is if it's a really important case, we've got abortion cases, we've got affirmative action cases, so many things in front of the Supreme Court that are critical, they can and historically have done, if it's those kind of cases and there looks like a split, they kick it to the next, to sort of the next go around, right? So the sessions are from June to October, which is a pretty good deal. So June, October. So what they would do is, instead of deciding cases before this October, they would kick it to next session, which begins in June of next year. And ideally, there might be a new Supreme Court justice at that point to help them determine those decisions. Because what they don't want to do is make a decision or take a really important issue and then just like lower court, right? That's a fancy law school term. What they don't want to do is just sort of leave it there. They if they brought it up and they want to decide it and they feel like it's a good case, they're going to wait for that final justice to help them make that decision. And so they would kick that to the next session. So those are sort of the options of how they're going to operate right now. And so we'll see in weeks to come sort of which ones they push, which ones they sort of kick back down to the lower court, and which ones they decide. I mean, they could decide 8 justices are enough. 6 justices are a quorum. So anything lower than 8 is enough. They can decide with the 8. And so, you know, a 7-1 decision is just as good as an 8-1 decision in the meantime.
And I think you're downplaying the fact that it allowed Justice Thomas to find his voice.
He spoke for the first time in 10 years, yes.
Because until now, he's been like a giraffe, capable of making a noise, but no one had ever actually heard one. So I thought that was key.
I'm sure that's right at the top
what
of their mind.
What sound do giraffes make?
We've never heard a giraffe, right? That's the thing. They clear their throats a lot.
Okay, so now the political angle. Carson, what should the Republicans in the Senate do? Now, in the here and now, before the election.
I think they've gone about it in completely the wrong way. I mean, I think they're this hardcore, no, we're not going to do any hearings, not going to take any sort of nomination.
Like the day he died, they came out and said no.
Not only was that kind of disrespectful, in my opinion, of kind of Scalia's legacy, but also I don't think it's a right political strategy for them. They control the Senate. They can determine how long a hearing takes. The Constitution is very clear. I mean, the president nominates, the Senate decides to confirm or not is the important thing. They don't have to confirm anyone. The president just chooses
to
nominate.
You'd rather they do the dance.
Of course. It'll take Obama, a few months to actually put up a nominee. I mean, no one was expecting Scalia to die. Now, maybe they were expecting some of the other ones to pass away. So they had a few, at least a short list of, candidates to nominate. But it's going to take him some time to do his vetting and put up a nomination. Then you have to go through the dance of, meeting with every single senator on the committee. And then the committee needs to do their investigation and hearings, and then they have to go to every single senator and do the courting. Then
it's 2017.
Then it has to So you can draw this thing out for as long as you really want to, or not as long as you really want to. And with Mitch McConnell being kind of the deciding factor here, why not? Make it at least look like you're doing it, and then stop the nominee until you'd actually know who your presidential nominee is going to be.
Obviously, this is over my head. But it would make Mitch McConnell a power broker, and isn't it possible that they could score more points by putting someone on the hearing stand and just peppering them with questions and so forth, and raising a whole bunch of the issues that the candidates are raising right now?
And then strategically also, that could convince the White House to put up someone a little bit more moderate, someone that may be able to get bipartisan support, that then if the Republicans do see they have a Trump as their nominee and they think, oh, dear God, the ship's going down, let's do this person because whoever, Clinton might nominee or
Barack
nominee,
Obama,
or Sanders,
perhaps.
Then, it could be Barack Obama.
I mentioned.
And you run the risk of losing the Senate, also with a Trump nomination. But right now, Obama has all of the incentive to nominate the most liberal person possible and then just kind of point to Republicans saying, oh, look at them, they're obstructing.
In this hyper-partisan mood that we've all been in, not we've all necessarily been in, but I mean that we're all kind of living in for so many years now, I do kind of want to take a moment just to note, one of Antonin Scalia's closest friend, Antonin Scalia, hardcore conservative, his Ruth Bader Ginsburg, very, very liberal
That's
justice.
The thing.
Yeah, I mean,
Supreme Court
is genuine good friends, traveled together and really respected.
Supreme Court is the only institution in D.C. that's not really kind of been consumed by partisanship. They have very ideological differences, but don't get me wrong there, but they all really respect each other's intellect and kind of thinking about how they go about everything. And so, this whole thing going on in the Senate is kind of not really up to the standard even of the Supreme Court. I mean, the Supreme Court justices probably don't even, if I was a fly in their chambers, probably they'd probably be bickering about what the Senate Republicans are doing right now. So,
okay. Well, some of you may have, our next topic, some of you may have noticed me hand a question card to Chuck, and that was someone who asked me to pass a note to him that's saying they loved your articles on the San Francisco homeless problem, and that's one of our topics. Really was a good job. And that's probably the first time someone actually gave you a positive.
Yeah. None of you are commenters on SF Chronicle, I can tell. So.
But tell us a bit about this, because this is a very serious issue, and part of what you were talking about was the capacity that the city has actually put forward or had built up to handle this or not.
Right.
So give us a if you would.
Well, I think we're all aware of the situation. And the number is $241 million we spend annually, which is half of the operating budget of the city of Oakland. And how is it possible that we still see people on the sidewalk in rainstorms? It's a terrible, terrible situation. So, well, one of the things that I suggested, and in my role as philosopher king, you know, I've been appointed by the mayor. I think the idea of saying we have a homeless problem is difficult to solve. We've got several different groups of people. It's much more diverse than that. And I think we begin with the people who are desperately mentally disturbed on the streets. And we, you know, those people need to get off the street. We've all seen them with a thin blanket on a sidewalk. And instead, what we've done, and it's very well-intentioned, is what's called a wellness model, which is that you try to approach the person on the street and you try to convince them that they would be better served if they came in and took mood-stabilizing drugs, which make them fat, unhappy, and depressed, instead of the meth that they've been using, which makes them happy and chipper for an hour and a half, and then they're good. I mean, it's seriously that much of a question. These people are saying, I'm depressed, I'm down, I know what would make me feel better. It would be methamphetamine. So I'd start with those people, and I would make an outreach. And what we've really done instead is cut the number of psychiatric acute care beds in San Francisco General. And it's the oddest story I've ever covered, because people from the acute care emergency ward get in contact with me, doctors and nurses, and say we're being forced to send these people back out on the streets, even though they're seriously mentally disturbed. And we know if we could keep them for a week, we could at least get them stabilized. And instead, we're not even keeping them 24 hours. And then you talk to the people at the hospital, the administrators and the spokespeople, and they're like, that's ridiculous. We haven't cut the beds at all. That's not true. It's all, you know, things are going very well. We're proud of our work. So I think there's a disconnect. I would also say families and children would be second. I'd start with the severely mentally ill. I'd go to families and children. And third, I'd go to the veterans, because not only do they serve the country, but they also have access to a lot of federal money from different sources.
Didn't the mayor at one point say he was going to look into conservatorships?
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happened?
Well, that's a tough one. As you would know, conservatorships are very difficult to get in San Francisco. They sound draconian.
Explain briefly.
A conservatorship would be, and I have a woman who writes me on a regular basis, and her son is now 28. He's bipolar. He's severely mentally ill. He goes up, he goes down. She described a situation to me where he was staying with them at the house, and he came downstairs and said, I have something I need to talk to you about. And her husband immediately ran for the phone to try to call 911, because he knew that when he said that, it was the beginning of a break. And he couldn't get there in time, and the son grabbed him and tossed him. He went over a table into the fireplace. The mother was trying to restrain him. I mean, it's a terrible, and she's begging to please put him in a conservatorship, give him an opportunity to have a more normal life, and for us to have a more normal life. And it just cannot get it through.
Conservatorship is kind of a power of attorney. So a person sort of, there's somebody else who is able to make medical decisions and decisions about whether they should be in treatment. And at one point, the city attorney mm-hmm. said that he was going to look into, like, the city basically getting its own conservatorship over some of these folks who run up really high bills at SF General. You know, every once in a while you read an article, maybe it's one of yours, that talks about how there's sort of a dozen or two dozen folks who are responsible for a large percentage of the spending we have on emergency services for these guys. So the idea was you take this, you know, this smaller group and you somehow get them under the conservatorship, and that way you can force them into treatment legally mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. running into any problems, but I was just, that hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened, and thanks for explaining it, because that's what I was supposed to do and I didn't do. But that's okay. But
your story actually was way better.
They're actually saying in the city, if they could get 100, they have 100 people identified, and if they could get them off the street and into care and get them stabilized, you'd see a big difference on the street. And it just seems impossible in a city with this kind of money and concern and services that we can't get those 100 people some kind of help. And I would just start with that. And from there on, I think, you know, there's obviously some people who are having drug addiction problems, and it may be politically incorrect, but I can tell you I've talked to people who say I would rather live on the street. I talked to a 21-year-old kid 3 weeks ago who had gone to college for a while. I thought he was some kind of a social worker. I thought he was, and he said, "No, I live in a tent right here on Division Street." And he said, "Yeah, you know, I have personal skills. I'll bet I could get a job, but you know, I just really like getting high." And he's spending time in that tent on Division Street, and I'd put those guys at the bottom of my list. I'd put the severely mentally ill. I'd put the people with children, women in particular, single women with children, single women by themselves. I'd do veterans. And then those 30-something age guys, you know, we'll get to you and we'll get these other guys taken care of. And I think it'd make a big difference on the street. But
we shall.
See, I am going to tell my wife that they applauded, and she's going to say, "Oh, come on, get serious."
This will be on TV and YouTube, and you'll be able to show her the proof.
I think the sad thing is there's a lot of state money available. The Prop 63, mm-hmm. which we passed in 2004, which put a 1% surcharge on millionaires, true millionaires, a personal income tax surcharge. That money is all dedicated toward mental health, health care. For the state. The problem is the state auditor, the little Hoover Commission, I mean, multiple reporters and news agencies have gone in and said there is absolutely no accountability about what this money is being used for. Some of the things is just unbelievable. I mean, the Hoover Commission determined that, you know, some of the money is going toward, I mean, like after school bullying programs and just, you know, a hip hop car wash being one of them, yoga and soul chi for the stressed. Just mean things that's not what the money was intended for, nor is it really helping the cause or the root cause here. So there's significant state money, about $1 billion a year, that could be going toward municipalities like San Francisco, like Fresno, many of the other big metropolitan areas where there is a homeless problem.
And to make Carson's point and to reinforce it, one of the reasons that we are now able to put Laura's Law in so many different communities, you know, Laura's Law goes county by county. And Laura's Law is the idea that you take someone severely mentally ill, you bring them into court, they appear before a judge, the judge says, "I want you to start taking your medication, you're going to do a drug test next week." There's no force, you can't coerce anyone to take their medication. But, in fact, it's had a lot of success. But the reason that nobody was implementing that was they didn't know how to administer it. And recently, to make Carson's point, because it's so specious what Prop 63 is funding, they made a decision it could fund Laura's Law. And Daryl Steinberg actually has reached out after I wrote that column, who was the author of 63, and I think is going to try to broaden the use of that money, which would be great. But it definitely is a work in progress. That's right.
And it's good to see Daryl Steinberg, because for a while, Steinberg was very, very kind of hands-off. He's like, "No, it's working great. Prop 63 is working great. Just give it some more time. That's all we need is more time." And I think finally, especially after being both the state auditor and the Little Hoover Commission, two very independent groups coming to the same decision a few years apart from each other, kind of showcasing that, no, this money isn't being used the best it possibly can. And on an issue like this, I mean, that's something where the state government should be investing resources.
Okay, well, I want to get another political item in here, which is, and this I'm going to stick with you, Carson, a bit of on the a story on the changing of the Republican Party, I mean, meaning the party itself, seems to be adapting to its role in the state differently. Could you explain it? Because if I try to explain it, it'll be very lame. But tell us what happened and what it means. Why is it important?
I'll try not to be lame. So what we recently saw just a week or two ago was the state of California, like many other states, has what's called a managed care organization tax. This is a tax on organizations, private insurers and public insurers that provide health care to Medicaid recipients. Because of the ACA, Obamacare, states had to kind of reconfigure how they did those taxes. Otherwise, they'd lose the federal funding for a significant portion or all of their Medicaid federal funding. California was one of them that the tax was not in compliance with the federal rules. So that means that California is going to lose a lot of money from the feds if they didn't kind of redo how this tax was done. Last year, Jerry Brown made a big point on kind of funding Medicaid, Medi-Cal, which is our version of Medicaid in the States, and really made a big push about reforming how the MCO tax was done in the state of California. Initially got massive pushback from Republicans, naturally, the no tax, no never knew any no tax ever party. And it really stalled. He created a special session in the state legislature. Nothing really ever happened. He brought it back again this year, really made it a central part of his state address again this year. Sat down with quite a few of the biggest MCOs in the state. They kind of came together with a good reform that they all could basically agree with. The Chamber of Commerce came in and said, yes, we're endorsing this plan. But the big question was, because Republicans have just enough seats in both chambers of the state legislature, you need at least some Republicans to cross over and vote for the tax, because under state law, any new tax requires a two-third vote. So the big question out there was, in an election year, will you be able to find the sufficient Republicans in order to pass this new tax? Jerry Brown made it a very big point of calling it tax reform. It's his tax reform, because it actually truly was tax reform. It was eliminating one tax and completely reconfiguring how not only the managed care tax was, but also how these healthcare companies would be dealt with under the corporate tax system and personal income tax system. And so, it was a very big question mark kind of going along as it moved through the committee and onto the Assembly and Senate floors. Will Republicans actually vote for it? And what we end up happening was, in the Assembly, 10 Republicans voted for it, and in the Senate, 2 Republicans voted for it. And it was supposed to be this big, dramatic moment where, you know, you're going to have Republicans, you know, going after Republicans, fights on the floor, you know, name calling, recall petitions being filed immediately.
We're all into the cars burning and
yes.
The band walking.
Oh yeah.
The wall.
I mean, think back, if you remember, to the Schwarzenegger tax deal that occurred. What was that? 2005, I think, where a group of Republicans crossed the aisle and voted for this tax because Schwarzenegger asked them to. I mean, most of their political careers went down in a fiery ball. After that. And so you're expecting a lot of the same thing, because Republicans ran in 2014 on saying we're the stopgap, no new taxes, because if you elect us. And now we have this tax reform. So it suggests, in my opinion, that the Republican caucuses are kind of realizing that they have to change their tune in order to be competitive in this state, and allowing certain members to vote their conscience whenever these type of votes are up, in order to kind of show the voters that we are listening to you, we understand your needs and wants, and that we will respond accordingly. It's a small step in the right direction, but a step nonetheless, in my opinion.
It'll be interesting to watch that. Yeah. We are going to move along, and before we get to the news quiz, I wanted to actually do a bit of a shout out to Michael Feldman, if any of you know him or have listened to his radio program at What Do You Know on public television, or radio, excuse me. I can see you're all fans. That might be part of why word came out today that they canceled this program. And full disclosure, I was an assistant on that program back when I was in college a quarter century ago. But if you listen to that program, you know that Michael Feldman was one of the best interviewers of children. And he was that rare interviewer who actually read the books of the people he was talking to. So rest in peace, What Do You Know? It was a great show while it lasted. Now let's do our news quiz. If I could have Tyler come up, Tyler's going to be our prize distributor. If any of you are new to this program, I'll briefly explain how we do the news quiz. I'm going to read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll point to you, and if you get it right, Tyler will deliver a bag of chocolates from Ghirardelli. So let's go. The first question. Just as the country is obsessing with fights over filling Justice Antonin Scalia's Supreme Court seat, the National Archives is preparing to release 56,000 records related to the failure of which Supreme Court nomination from George W. Bush. Do you remember this? So someone he put forward in the back there. Harriet Myers, that's correct. Very good. So, does anyone know why Harvard Law School is likely to change its 80-year-old crest? In the back there. That's right. It's based on the crest of a slave-owning family that had basically dumped a bunch of money at the law school years before. Very good. So if you are tired of either paying for expensive real estate here in San Francisco or Northern California, Or
who gets
tired of hearing about. Yeah, I know. It's a never-ending joy. However, you might want to move to what down-on-its-luck city where the median home price has dropped to $14,000. It's not in California. Sir?
Flint, Michigan,
that's right. $14,000. One person actually bought a house for $1 there. So
you also get all the lead you can drink.
So. Yes, yes. Bring your own bottle of water. Too soon, I think.
Too soon.
Okay. This past weekend saw the death of the author of Prince of Tides. Who was it? Sir? Sorry? Pat Conroy, that's correct. International news. The Philippines is seizing a cargo ship from what country as part of... I saw your hand right up there. Sorry? North Korea. That's right. It's part of the sanctions that have just been strengthened against them. What country sentenced a billionaire to death over corruption charges? Sir? Iran. That's right. Okay. What did Turkey's government take over this weekend? Ma'am, sorry. That's right. Actually, the largest newspaper in Turkey, I think it's Zaman. I don't know if that's Zaman or Zaman. Zaman? Okay. So how many more do we have in the bag?
Three more.
Okay. Let's do this. Pope Francis was reportedly, quote, shocked and profoundly saddened, unquote, by a murderous attack that killed 16 people, including four nuns, hence his making a comment. In what country? Did you see this story? Way in back there? Yemen, that's correct. Okay, and in heartwarming, life-affirming news, billionaire media owner Rupert Murdoch married whom this weekend? Ma'am. Jerry Hall, that is correct.
I don't want to talk about
okay,
it.
And for our very last one, NATO claims that Russia is waging an information war over the Syrian refugee crisis in an attempt to overthrow whom? Did you see the story? There's someone they know this will cause trouble for, and they're hoping it will... let's say, put her out of office. Sir. Sorry? German Chancellor Angela Merkel. That is correct. Well, listen, we are going to have more news quiz questions. If those of you got the handout, I actually have the wrong time on our next program. It's not in the afternoon. It is at 6:30 as usual on Monday, March 21st, right here in this room. You can also find our week-to-week news quiz every week on Huffington Post. Thank you to our panel, Chuck Nevius, Melissa Kane, Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you here, everyone listening online and watching TV. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.